So, hi Ed, how are
Hi,
you?
Paul.
It's
I'm good.
good to see you again today.
You too.
Some of our meetings have brought us together more often than usual, so I'm grateful that you took the time to be with me so that we can share some thoughts and feelings about NKP and ourselves. So tell me, I guess one of the things I'm real interested in is understanding what brought you to the NWTA. What was going on in your life? How did you get to go into some crazy weekend like the NWTA?
Well, it's a long story. I'll try to make it short. I've been doing personal growth work my entire life, going back to the 60s. And along with that, I'd been being a social activist and working as a management consultant, those three threads. So in first part of the 2000s, I was working with a company that did management consulting and also women's leadership training. And the women in the company, about 400 women had gone through the women's leadership training, and they started saying, "Well, what about the men?" So, long story short, that brought me in contact with Ray Arata, who's had been participating in MKP for, at that time, more than 10 years. And he and I were working on creating programs around male allyship. And he said, "Well, you should do this weekend. You should get to know MKP." And I said, "Well, you know, I've done every personal growth workshop there is. Why do I want to do another one?" And basically he said, "Because I asked you to." And so I did, and was really knocked out by the quality of the weekend and the impact of the weekend, even against other work I had done, or even a cumulative lifetime of work. I saw stuff I'd never seen before. And got interested in MKP as an organization, first in Northern California, where I live, and then on a national level.
So let's go back to the weekend for a little bit. You spoke about how it was different than anything you'd done before, and the impact was big. Can you share a little bit with us about the internal impact? What happened to you on the inside from that experience? What did you see, or what happened that was so different?
That's a great question. All the work I had done up until then had focused on where I got in my own way. Not to put too fine a point on it, focused on what was wrong. That particular weekend, and particularly the work I did on the carpet, focused on gold rather than shadow for me. I know for a lot of men, it's appropriate to focus on shadow. I had done that work, and what I had never done was own what was positive about me. It was like, that was a given, and now let's work on what's wrong. In the weekend, it was, hey, you know, take a look at yourself. I know, 71 years old when I did the weekend. And that began a process that's continued to now of really focusing on strengths rather than wounds and weaknesses. So I'd say that was the single biggest thing about it that struck me. That and the fact that I had really never hung around with men very much. You know, the relationships I had with men were largely competitive. Even when they were friendly, they were competitive. And it opened up the possibility of relating to men in a whole different way, of a more vulnerable and emotionally closer relationship with other men.
Would you say that it just opened you up to be more vulnerable and more trusting of men that maybe you weren't?
I don't think in terms of trust.
Uh-huh.
For me, it was really about not having anything to prove.
Mm.
Letting go of having to prove that I was good enough, smart enough, and by those things I mean better than you and smarter than you.
Mm-hmm.
That's how enough got measured.
So the competitiveness really sort of started to leave you around men.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Great.
Very much so.
So tell me from there, I've had just a wonderful time getting to know you in the last 2 years, 2.5 years, and in your involvement. So from that experience, you obviously were impacted enough to want to give a lot of your time. I know then, and you can share with us a little bit. I know in NorCal, you've done a bunch of work, and now nationally, you've been involved for 3 or 4 years that I'm aware of.
Well, pretty much from the time I did the weekend. Go ahead.
So what made that happen? That's, I guess, what I'm wanting to get to. What happened inside of you that said, man, I want to work here.
That wasn't new. I've always been somebody who jumps into things with both feet. And I've always been a leader in any. So it's actually a pattern for me. I mean, when I moved to Lake Tahoe and I joined the synagogue, the next thing I knew, I was president there for 4 years. And I could just give you example after example of that. And you know, I don't participate in a lot of things. You know, right now my professional work and MKP are most of what I participate in. Mm-hmm. But what I do participate in, I tend to give myself completely to it and contribute everything I possibly can. And the idea being that I pretty much only participate in things that are consistent with my purpose, with my mission, mm-hmm. To make the world a better place. MKP looked like a terrific vehicle to do that. I mean, we've got almost 70,000 men around the world. 10,000 men a week that sit in I groups here in North America. And by and large, they are men who to a greater or lesser extent are living in socially responsible missions.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for me, after a lifetime, as I said, of social activism, and it's just a natural fit.
So tell me briefly, in NorCal, you started right away. You went through the weekend and got engaged, pretty involved in leadership.
Well, I got into an I group. I'd actually sat in an I group a couple times before the weekend, as mm-hmm. so many men do now. And when I came out, I looked for what to get involved in, and a couple of different committees, and to true to form, next thing I knew, I was area steward.
Mm-hmm.
I was on the council for a while. It was right at the time that we transitioned from being an independent region to being part of MKP USA. And Ray, my friend, now my business partner, was the interim center director, and was the area was about to transfer to being an area to having an area steward, and I'd done some things while he was center director and served on the council, and I staffed a lot, and I figured, well, I can do this, so I jumped in and decided I wanted to be the one who shepherded the transition to unification.
So it sounds like you were a big part of the unification transforming from North.
Post-unification. It had already happened, but I was the one who, I was the area steward during the immediate, I was the first post-unification area steward.
Mm-hmm. So you led the integration of unification yes. in NorCal.
Well, to the extent, yeah, led the beginning of it. I mean, there's still work to do, but I did. And part of, for whatever reason, part of the request, the ask when I got elected area steward was that I be at every NWTA during my 2-year term. So I did, which gave me a, I mean, frankly, it burned me out a little bit because I did, I think, at least eight NWT staffed at least eight NWTAs in 2 years. I think it was actually a little more than that. But it gave me a terrific grounding in the weekend, but also in the principles of MKP. I've always been somebody who learns from first principles. So I just dug in and, you know, why do we do this? And what is this? And where does that come from? And in the course of that, we began to introduce Holacracy, which I introduced in Northern California. And, you know, got a chance to get to learn about that and use it and see the value of it. So, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, there's a pattern there. Just, I don't do anything. I don't stick toes in the water. I generally go head first.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand that part. So tell me a little bit.
I knew you would.
Yeah. tell me a little bit about, so now you're in the third year of a 3-year chair term. We have a 3-year structure. And so how did you get from area steward to chair? And then I want to talk more about you and chair and a few other things. So tell me how that it sounds to me like it's a natural progression as to who you are. Well, I've done this, I need to keep going.
It pretty well was. I mean, I was already sitting on a couple of national, what were then committees or now circles. I met John Levitt shortly after I did the weekend, and he asked me to get involved in organizational development circle, and specifically as national enrollment lead, which was pretty natural for me. I've been involved in enrolling people into programs most of my life. So I did that and really kind of created that post and moved the average enrollment in NWTAs nationally up a couple of points during the 2 years that I did that. And then I got on risk management and a couple of other committees that interested me, finance. And a lot of people, because I've worked with organizations, I've been in organizational development and as a consultant my whole career, people who were in organizational posts, when treasurer wanted me on the finance committee because of my organizational chops. So I was pretty involved nationally. And after 2 years as area steward, I mean, I love Northern California. I love the area. It's my home. But I really wanted to do something that would have more of a national or international impact. So at that time we had the board and the council. I ran for the council and I lost. So I figured the next election, well, if I can't be on the council, I guess I'll run for chair. as it happened, a couple of people had been asking me to, and nobody else stepped up, so I couldn't lose. Yeah, 3 years ago, I stepped in as chair-elect, and then a year as chair, and now a year as past chair.
So what's that been like? You know, the chair position gets a lot of conversation about how complicated and hard it is. And
it's not hard. It is it's complex. It's not complicated. It's complex because as with any – I mean – the way I talk about it in organizations, and it applies here, is that everybody who's involved in running the organization sees it through a lens. Finance sees it through the lens of money. HR sees it through the lens of people. The executive committee and the board might see it through the lens of strategy, but only one person has a view of the entire organization. And that's the CEO in a for-profit company, or the chair in MKP. Now, the way we've got it set up, that view grows over 3 years. Mm-hmm. So when I was chair-elect, I saw the whole organization, but kind of not very deeply. Mm-hmm. As chair, I deepened what I saw, and the good, the bad, and the ugly, and it's become even deeper in my years as past chair. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that the past chairs over the years, people like Mike Elser and David Bowerly and Robert Powell, others, Julian Devereaux, Jose Mondello, all those people are still around. Mm-hmm. And they're still contributing. And I'm certainly not going anywhere. The nice thing is, I have an opportunity to stay on the board as secretary, mm-hmm. Which I'm going to run for now that my term as past chair is over, and to participate in leadership. So it is complex. It's complex. It involves people, which makes any job enormously complex. When I was a college professor, we had a joke that this would be a great place to work if it wasn't for the students. And most of us thought that applied to the other professors as well. But it's to find that balance, between the needs of the institution, the needs of the individuals, my own, I don't want to say needs, but commitments and purpose, mm-hmm. and the resources. And, I know that what I just said was the four quadrants of integral mm-hmm. theory.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I really developed a tremendous respect for that, because in so many cases, whether it's about an individual, or it's about a group, the needs of the, utilitarian philosophy says the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. Mr. Spock said that in one of the Star Trek movies too. And given our values, we can't ignore the needs of the few or the individual. Mm-hmm. We've got to find that balance between. Great example is this business about bringing leaders in from outside the United States. You've got the individual leaders who want to lead here, mm-hmm. and you've got the group here in the United States that wants to have that diversity, that variety, those other perspectives on the world. Mm-hmm. And you've got the law, which sets constraints on how people can get paid and how they can come into the country to get paid. Mm-hmm. And you've got the organization, which, on the one hand has to follow the law, and on the other hand, wants to have the benefit of that.
Yeah.
And so the complexity of the chair is really that. It's not just a balancing act, because in a balancing act, you're either going to fall left or right. This is three-dimensional chess. You can fall left, right, up, or down, and what you're trying to do is balance there rather than commit yourself, you know, like we're gonna worry about the institution and the hell of the individual, or we're gonna follow the law and, you know, we don't care what anybody wants.
Yeah.
We got to follow the law, but we care what people want.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's clearly a key part of who we in MKP have always been. You know, mm-hmm. It's about the whole, all the different pieces and parts. And I think from my perspective at this stage of my journey in the three-chair structure, you've really nailed it real well about the complexity of the piece. But what I really like is that you included yourself in the pieces that you were needing to serve. So if you could take a minute to tell me, how have you done that in the complexity of this work? I have personally never seen you overwhelmed with the work. I've always seen a strong, I'm not saying you haven't been.
No, I have a filter on my video camera, Paul.
That's great.
Filters out. No, I'm.
So how have you taken
care of yourself? I have been whelmed and at times overwhelmed.
Yeah. So how have you taken care of yourself in the midst of this? You know, this has been a real interesting journey for me, making sure that the balance in my whole life is honored. So how have you taken care of that? How have you taken care of the personal parts of your own?
It really is what we used to call a continuous adjustment procedure. So when I was staffing a lot, like 6-7 times a year, mm-hmm. I had to pay really close attention. My children are grown. It's me and my wife. Mm-hmm. And none of the kids live near enough that, you know, we see a lot of them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I had to take into account that I was leaving her alone on a lot of weekends. Mm-hmm. And she eventually didn't like it. And I agreed to cut back. I don't staff as much as I did. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of rules for myself. In a conflict between my business and MKP, my business comes first. And you and everybody else knows that. I'll cancel out of a meeting, an MKP meeting, if a client wants me.
Right.
That's another way I've taken care of myself. The other thing is just, I don't know. It's never been a big issue for me. You know, I always love that part of that quote from George Bernard Shaw that says, "The harder I work, the more I live." Hmm. So I've never, you know, I take time off. I don't ski like I used to or play golf, but I'll go for a walk or go to the gym or, you know, or sometimes like yesterday after a really long day of calls, I just decide, okay, I'm going to go grocery shopping and go to Costco and Trader Joe's and, you know, just for a change of pace.
Yeah,
because I enjoy that.
I'm laughing because you were doing that for yourself and guess who called you twice?
Yeah, well, but that's okay. That's a good point, Paul. The other thing, I have a system where I have my cell phone and my office phone, mm-hmm. and I forward one to the other so I can always get calls. Well, sometimes when I go out, like to go shopping, I don't change it. I leave my cell phone forwarded to my office phone, and nobody can reach me. Now, I know that you or anybody else, my wife, if it's an emergency, you'll text me or whatever. But one of the things I've learned, and, you know, as I've gotten older, is there's very few emergencies in life.
Yeah.
Probably the best way to deal with anything really urgent is let it age a little bit.
Yeah.
See if it's still urgent an hour later.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My dad used to call it, let it soak.
Exactly right. Exactly. I wrote a paper on this. I don't remember, but about the tyranny of the urgent. You know, there's what's important and there's what's urgent. And if something's urgent and important, you need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But if something's urgent and not important, we tend to go do it anyhow because it's urgent.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't pay attention to the fact that it's not important. And most of the really, really, the real gold in life is in what's important and not urgent.
Mm.
So, you know, I used to think if I was working on something, I had to get it out that day. Well, I don't do that so much anymore.
Yeah, good. So tell me, in the beginning, we talked about your experience with the NWTA, and you got into a better relationship with men in general. That was a different thing. And then the other thing you said was that you have kind of, it shifted your competitive feeling, how, you know, internally, where you were competing so that you could be better than, or that you could be the best of, or something in that arena. How has that shown up now, 6-7 years later, in this work and in your professional work? How has that shown up for you inside of yourself?
I'm easier with myself. You know, I was never competing with other people. I was always competing with myself. I was always competing with my perception that my parents liked my brother better than they did me, and I had to prove I was as good as he was. I've let that go. I don't know. It's hard to say how much of it's the work, how much of it is being 76 years old. But, you know, there's an old Pennsylvania Dutch saying, we get too soon old and too late smart.
I'm still working on the smart.
Me too.
Old, so.
Me too. Yeah. But that's the thing. You know, I can't escape thoughts about, geez, if I had only known, you know, when I was 40.
Yeah.
And the truth is, I didn't do bad in life, but I could have done so much better if I had dealt with these wounds. It's why I love seeing young men go through the weekend. It's why I love to see young, there's men in my, I'm one of the oldest people in my eye group, and some of them are pretty young. And I love seeing them struggling with stuff that I wish I had struggled with.
Wow. So if you were going to share with me, I know that we're in the process of, you know, working to select a new person for our triad, our three chair system, which we call chair elect, which is kind of a funny misnomer because they are elected when they're put into that place for the chair. So how would you, if I were interested or I was kind of shy about it, or what would you say to me, and what would you share of the depth of the experience that why I would kind of want to do it, or how would you talk to me about that?
First of all, does it call to you? Does leadership, and by the way, there's leadership and leadership and leadership. I'm talking about organizational leadership. You know, some people are called to be program leaders. Some people are called to be community leaders. That's all great. I've done all those things. The thing that calls to me most is organizational leadership. So number one, does it call to you? If it does, why aren't you putting your hat in the ring? What's stopping you? What's the concern or consideration that's in the way? Well, I don't consider myself experienced enough. I have a concern about time, you know, whatever it is. You know, sometimes on the weekend, if a man, you know, we're during accountability, if we're talking about a man being late, we say, if you knew there was $1 million waiting for you and it was going to go away at 5:30, would you have been on time? Well, there's $1 million worth of living your mission. If being an organizational leader calls to you, there's $1 million worth of living your mission waiting for you. And if there was a real $1 million, and you were concerned you weren't experienced enough, and you were concerned you didn't have the time or whatever, you'd do it. You'd go for it. Now, you might not get it because you might not be experienced enough, or you might not be able to give it the time, but you'd go for it. This is, Julian Devereaux said to me when I took over his chair, he said, I want you to remember two things. One, you're never not the chair. What you say carries a different weight than than it ever did before. And it will always carry, what I've learned is it'll always carry that.
Yes.
It doesn't end at the end. You know, when you, on December 31st, your voice as chair is not going to go away. Mm-hmm. But the second thing was, he said, you'll never have, and I think this was something that Elser or Bowerly said to him, you'll never have a better or bigger opportunity to bless men. Mm-hmm. And it's taken me, when I was chair-elect, I had no idea what the hell he was talking about. When I was chair, I began to get a glimmering of it. It's in my year as past chair that I've fully realized what he was talking about. Because it's not just, hey, bless you, man. It's to see men, to speak to who I can see that they are. Even when, the chair is somebody who will remember who you are when you forget. Mm-hmm. And remind you and hold you to account for your greatness. And for me, the advice I would give any man who's called to it is, don't listen to the arguments for your limitations. Oscar Wilde said, argue for your limitations and they're yours. Step into it, step into your greatness, and know that you're going to stumble and slog around in the muck and, do all kinds of stuff like that. But in the end, you will live your mission in a way that you never have before.
Great. Yes, there's so much more to talk about, so many things, so many directions we can. I hope we come back and do some more of this.
All right.
I want to thank you for taking the time and giving me your time for this.
It's my pleasure, Paul.
For all of us that are viewing this. And I want to just take a little bit of time here to tell you how meaningful you've been in my life. We met more formally, personally, at the land of my grandfather's 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was working toward becoming chair-elect. I hadn't become chair-elect yet, and you were chair-elect.
I believe I twisted your arm.
Well, we were walking around, and, I was kind of – I clearly believed that I was being called into the role, but I was kind of confused about it. And that brings back up Julian. One of the things that he said to me that I've always held is, if you ever try to get your arms around this, forget it. And that's the mystery and magic that lives in this organization, but it's really true. Trying to make sense out of it half the time doesn't really work. But anyway, this isn't about Julian. This is about you. We walked around and you could see in me the caution, or the, I wouldn't say resistance, but just
hesitancy.
Yeah, hesitancy. Thanks for that. And you just put your arm around me and just told me, look, you're going to be awesome. And if anybody gets in your way, I'll kick their ass. So you have held that for me. We share a piece you said earlier about not seeing my own value, not getting, it's really hard for me to see what others, and you've always reminded me what that is. And I've just grown to love you more and more all the time. And I just also want you to get it, how much you've changed men's lives all over the country, all over the world, through your impact and how you've communicated, how you've led, and all of the work you did in NorCal and in the steps that you came before you became a chair. And, I'm not the only one that's been affected by your gold, the gold that you now are in touch with much more than you were before.
And I appreciate that very much, Paul. I appreciate your saying it.
We would not be here without you in this particular place, and I'm grateful for that. So thanks for your time again, and the blessing.
All right, brother.
All right, take care.
Take care.
Thanks.